Blog Talk Radio.
De boule est donnée de la terre, de boule est force de la faim. La raison connaissant la terre, c'est l'éruption de la faim. Tout passé est dans ta place. Le monde va changer de base, nous ne sommes rien, soyons tous. C'est la lutte finale, reprends-nous et demain. L'internationale sera le genre humain. C'est la lutte finale, reprends-nous. Wake up, you prisoners of hunger. The world is changing at the base. We who have been nothing will be everything. Of the past, we shall make a clean slate. Still keep your friends, though. He says, it's the final battle. Then he says, we need no supreme saviors, no God, no Caesar. Producers, save yourselves. Heat up your own forge. Soufflons nous même notre forge. Blow upon the forge and make it hot. Beat on the iron while it is hot. Il n'est pas de sorte suprême, ni Dieu, ni César, ni Tigrin. Producte, sauvons-nous nous-mêmes, décrétons le salut commun, pour que le voleur de gorge, pour tirer l'esprit du cachot, soufflons. Nous mêmes notre forge, battant le fer quand il est chaud. Et le lutte finale, groupons-nous et demain. L'internationale sera le genre humain. Et le lutte finale, groupons-nous. International sera le genre humain. I won't sing all six verses, but it says, the kings intoxicate us with gun smoke. If they insist upon making heroes of us, they will learn that our bullets are for our own generals. Workers, peasants, are we all? The world belongs to everyone. How many feed upon our flesh? But if one day these buzzards, these vultures would all disappear, the sun will shine always. Ouvrier paysan, nous sommes le grand parti des travailleurs. La terre n'appartient qu'aux hommes, voici dira le gérail. Combien de nos chasseurs épaissent, mais si les corbeaux les vautours, un de ces matins disparaissent, le soleil brillera toujours. C'est le lutte finale. Groupons-nous et demain, l'internationale sera le genre humain. C'est la lutte finale, groupons-nous et demain, l'internationale. le vent remarque.
Read from the preface of the book Professor John Graham edited. I received a letter the other day. Jack London wrote in 1905. It was from a man in Arizona. It began, "Dear comrade," it ended, "Yours for the revolution." I replied to the letter, and my letter began, "Dear comrade," it ended, "Yours for the revolution." In the United States, there are 400,000 men, of men and women nearly 1 million, who begin their letters, "Dear comrade," and end them, "Yours for the revolution." Although now almost erased from our collective memory by a national history that is selectively focused on the American character, war, party politics, ideas, and great men to the virtual exclusion of faceless, inarticulate, working people and insurgent radicals. Those same Americans, native-born and immigrant alike, created a revolutionary socialist movement as the 20th century began. By revolution, they meant a fundamental economic, political, and cultural change in the social reality brought about by American capitalism's newly developed industrial and financial order. The electoral agent in the movement for radical change was the Socialist Party. Its method was to be democratic victory at the polls. However, American socialism was composed of much more than the party itself. The activist counter-institution that propelled the new movement, the socialist newspaper, that more than any other reveals the movement's life and aspirations, its victory and defeats, its politics, consciousness, and culture was the appeal to reason. The industrial transformation of the United States profoundly altered America's landscape and social relations. An agricultural, rural republic, immediately following the Civil War, America and its centers of power became predominantly urban by 1900. The population greatly increased and became ethnically enriched as millions of new immigrants entered the country and an economic elite developed that derived its power from its ownership of banks and credit, mills, railroads, mines, and the massive factories that increasingly became the principal form of production. Monopolies and trusts arose to prevent competition between sometimes opposing interests within the business elite and the newly powerful corporation, directly as well as indirectly through its influence in federal and state governments, became the instrument to plan and order the nation's economic and political life. Stop for a minute. Are you listening, folks? How strange to hear these words. And think of today, where we're at right now. For many Americans, the sweeping changes in the conditions of life created an awareness of class relations. In the span of a single post-Civil War generation, the 1890 U.S. Census reports, 1% of the population took for itself more of the national wealth remaining citizens owned, and the bulk of the population faced daily struggles for economic survival. In a country with both revolutionary and long-standing Christian traditions of social justice, a country in which the recognition that one class of people could not justly be subordinated to another class was still a reverberating legacy from the Civil War, a significant proportion of Americans took promises of economic as well as political liberty seriously. Millions of citizens did not, in short, passively acquiesce to corporate capitalism's operative denial of egalitarian ideals and opportunities. Those Americans were not the ignored and invisible subjects of our standard history text, nor were they mere economic beings who were blindly, voicelessly pushed about by vast economic forces that they could neither understand nor affect. Instead, resourceful, sometimes rebellious Americans interacted inventively with their varied circumstances and affirmatively made their own history. Throughout the latter years of the 19th century, working people refused to become alienated factory operatives and instead organized labor unions. Landless tenants and migrants refused to become degraded instruments of a landlord's profit and organized insurgent agricultural movements. As the 20th century began, the inheritor of many of these democratic strivings was the Socialist Party. The principal expression of the socialist movement, the newspaper, that introduced socialism into the public discourse was the Appeal to Reason. No American newspaper has had the character, impact, and indignant fervor of the Appeal, founded by J. A. Whalen and published after 1897 in Girard, Kansas, edited by Whalen and Fred Warren during its most influential years. No left paper in America has mobilized insurgent sentiment as successfully as The Appeal, or matched its paid circulation and vast readership. During political campaigns and crisis, single-issue printings reached as high as 4,100,000 copies, a world record. The paper's staff liked the comment that broke tolls The Appeal had itself earlier established. If there were working conditions or a strike to publicize in West Virginia, Colorado, or California, The Appeal was there. If Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Schenectady, New York, voted the socialist ticket, Appeal correspondents reported the victories. If states were without their own socialist newspapers, The Appeal printed individual state editions. If capitalist muck needed to be raked in Chicago, Fred Warren suggested a novel about the meatpacking industry to Upton Sinclair and sent an advance to write it, and then serialized the jungle in The Appeal. The Appeal had a profound effect on American during its nearly 30 years of publication. The Appeal's fundamental purpose was twofold, quote, to war against oppression and vast wrongs, dispelling the tears, the blood, the woe of capitalism, unquote, and to imbue Americans with actively egalitarian non-exploitative values. The voters could be made to understand that capitalism functioned by denying workers the full product of their labor, that socialism would permit a just distribution of the nation's wealth and opportunities, and create the conditions for human freedom to flourish. Capitalism and its political superstructure could be voted out of existence. As a mass circulation newspaper during a period when the printed word had much greater power than presently, the Appeal battled effectively against the American capital's growing control over national consciousness. The only radical newspaper distributed in many areas of the United States, the Appeal brought non-capitalist news and culture to millions of Americans. I'll end there and begin my interview with the editor who wrote these words, Professor John Graham. A real honor to do this for you, folks. I hope you listen in. We'll hear some readings from the Appeal by various voices as well. In the last hour, Fred Whitehead. And part two will begin tomorrow on May 1st, 2010. Next Saturday at high noon. Here we go. Listeners, you're in for a treat. I have on the other end of the line Professor John Graham, who's retired, I believe, and he taught American literature and American studies at the University of Colorado. I've tracked him down after a couple years of ruminating like a goat. I was ruminating on how would I best be able to find the editor and head honcho of a book that I have called Yours for the Revolution. It's about the Appeal to Reason, 1895 to 1922, edited with an introduction and by Professor Graham. The book was printed in 1990 and floated around quite a ways. I came upon it later, I believe in 1992, right before Dr. Fred Whitehead, who you hear listeners regularly on Radio Free Kansas, Dr. Fred Whitehead, who edited and wrote the introduction for Free Thought on the American Frontier, co-edited with Burl Muir. And this book came along in Free Thought on Whitehead's Free Thought on the American Frontier. There were several chapters on an interesting editor named Fred Warren who edited the Appeal to Reason. And that got my taste because I never knew that the largest socialist newspaper, weekly newspaper, came out of Little Girard, Kansas. So when I made a determined effort through the wonders of the Internet, I found Professor John Graham, and I'd like to welcome you. Professor Graham, hello. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas.
Well, Radio Free Kansas, it sounds like a great operation.
Yeah, well, you're on a long litany of distinguished guests.
There you go.
Well, Professor Graham, when did you start to conceive of this idea? Could you tell us where you first learned of the Appeal to Reason? And because your book was my first real taste of what the true historical significance of it. Where did you hear of the Appeal to Reason? How long ago?
That would have been in the very, very late 1960s or the early 1970s.
Uh-huh.
And that came as a consequence of doing research on the 1913-1914 coal strike, which some of your listeners may remember because it culminated in a state militia, National Guard massacre of striking miners and their families, the name of which has continued on in American history, called the Ludlow Massacre.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And since the appeal to reason was being published at the same time, it became an obvious place to do what a responsible academic does, which is to say, research and read it, because you get a perspective from the appeal that is rather different
mm-hmm.
than a Denver paper like the Rocky Mountain News, together with the fact that I turned up in Upton Sinclair's papers, who wrote about that 1913-1914 strike, what was, in fact, a yet unpublished novel.
Mm-hmm.
And you will know about Upton Sinclair because of about 80 books he wrote, including The Jungle.
The Jungle was serialized in the Weekly Appeal to Reason,
was. And the beginnings of The Jungle, in fact, were provoked by Fred Warren, and certainly one of the very best editors of The Appeal, who had read a novel that Sinclair had written on the Civil War, and wrote to Sinclair, gave him, I think, $500, which doesn't sound like much these days, but was a considerable sum then, to go to Chicago and live among the workers at the...
the meatpacker.
Slaughterhouses.
Which were foreign immigrants, largely. I remember reading that in my freshman year. And now they're reading it in high school. serialized in the Appeal to Reason. Well, you know, this was Fred Warren, evidently. You wrote something here in your introduction that I wanted to call your attention to that I thought was pretty amazing. No American newspaper has had the character, impact, and indignant fervor of the Appeal, founded by J.A. Wayland and published after 1497 in Grant Girard, Kansas. Edited by Wayland and Fred Warren during its most influential years, no left paper in America has mobilized insurgent sentiment as successfully as The Appeal, or matched its paid circulation and vast readership. During political campaigns and crises, single-issue printings reached as high as 4,100,000 copies, a world record. The paper's staff liked to comment that broke tolls The Appeal had itself earlier established. Professor Graham, no one knows about that in present-day Kansas, I assure you.
Well, everything you read, I have to say, is absolutely accurate and true. I don't even know, in a sense, where to begin.
Well, what can we started with Wayland. You know, Wayland came from Indiana. He started a newspaper out there called Coming Nation, and I'm trying to think of the historical context to describe 1890, the 1890s through the 1920s in rural America, and it's sort of. I mean, this is so self-contradictory. I guess there was the populist movement, a Kansas People Party, that had something to do with this grand alliance with the farmers and the stuff. But socialist fervor came through the country, and it had its ebbs and ties. But what could you help me out on that, Professor Graham? I mean, what?
That period that you're describing, say 1890 to 1920, had the greatest flourishing of anti-capitalist popular insurgent struggle of any time in American history. One of the small terms that still survives is robber barons. And from the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, the quick, sudden, as we would say, looking at history, industrialization by industrial capital and finance capital really did occur in something like 30 years, which is a phenomenally short time, historically speaking. A good section of the American population did not exactly look at what was occurring, given the distribution of wealth, the movement of wealth upward into the owners of banks and factories, all that happily. So the greatest, I think one can responsibly say, the greatest challenge to the capitalist way occurred, say, the 1880s, 1890s, and sure, first with the populist movement and the People's Party, which largely began in Texas, or originally began in Texas, in schoolhouses and churches, made its way particularly through the Midwest and the South. And then when they were effectively crushed, in some part when our leaders, William Jennings Bryan, colluded with one of the national parties, the Democrats, the Democratic Party. That was really the end of the radical insurgency that the People's Party had going. So then the aftermath of that was the American Socialist Party, which for 20 years, basically, it was formed literally in 1901 and was crushed during World War I and the Red Scare thereafter, 1919, 1920, that was the next appearance of a challenge to American capital.
Well, you know, I was reading in the book, in this book, again, readers, we're listening to Professor John Graham talk about the book he edited and wrote the introduction to, Yours for the Revolution. You know, I wrote in the by the way, it's published by the University of Lincoln.
University of Nebraska.
The University of Nebraska Press out of Lincoln. you know, the subscriptions, there probably isn't a flow chart. That would be too 21st century for someone to sit down and figure. The flow chart on the subscriptions rates when the appeal started in the I think it was 1899 or something like that when he started it. I'm not sure, but it went for. I bet there were spikes. I understand it. Near as I could discern from the pages, it would go from. It went up to like 60,000 to 90,000 a week, and then they would have these special campaigns. But two times, I think, weren't they in trouble with the federal government over postal, the use of the postals for, I can't remember, what was the appeal prosecuted for? How was it?
The appeal was prosecuted because of anti-capitalist agitation and propaganda. And what I should probably say about propaganda is that hopefully some few of your listeners might figure or identify as propaganda coming from the left or the right. Unfortunately, that's only part of it. Something like, for example, the New York Times has propaganda coming from the middle. All of these newspapers have a point of view. And back at the point of, for example, the 1890s, 1900, national political parties, state political parties, all sponsored and directed newspapers.
Right. I think a lot of people have forgotten that.
and the newspapers obviously reflected the politics of the party sponsoring them.
Well, right. And I noticed that the appeal through in the edited stuff that's in here, you have whole clippings, letters from letters and letters. I guess thousands of letters came from readers to it, and they published parts of as many of the letters as they could. Plus, people like Kate O'Hare, Helen Keller. Listeners, you remember Helen Keller, Patty Duke in the movie The Miracle Worker, I think it was. But you know, there's all these remarkable personalities, Upton Sinclair, as you mentioned earlier, revolving Eugene Debs, who of course was the presidential candidate several times for the Socialist Party. They all, I guess, at one time or another, traveled through or became intimate as correspondents to the Appeal to Reason. Isn't that right?
Yeah, they worked there, or at least some of them did. I did not see The Miracle Worker, so I can't comment on it. But Helen Keller is a name that reverberates down historically. One of the parts of Helen Keller's life, a considerable part, is that she was a socialist.
Uh-huh.
And if I'm remembering correctly, when she wrote an autobiography, one of her last chapters was originally titled Why I Am or
uh-huh.
Why I Became a Socialist.
Uh-huh.
Suffice it to say, the publisher excised. Censored that chapter.
Uh-huh.
It's a little bit like, in her case, it's a little bit like Jack London, whom I quote, the appeal quotes any times. Jack London is famous for dog stories.
Yeah, Call of the Wild. I read him as a boy, Call of the Wild, White Fang.
I did too.
Yeah.
What he is not known for is, of course, he was a socialist and a writer in support of American socialism, too. So what one gets, of course, is what not only people, but historians, responsible historians, describe as history written by winners about winners. So the losers and their beliefs, whether Helen Keller's or Jack London's, don't exactly make it into mainstream media or high schools.
Yeah. Well, that's what I know of Jack London. But, you know, so these personalities are weaved in and out of the appeal to reason, the weekly so-called literary life of the appeal to reason, right?
Yeah. And as many people did, just quickly in passing, to read a Jack London story that isn't about Call of the Wild, a novel by Jack London, I'd recommend The Iron Heel, and you'll get a sense of the Jack London that dog stories don't make appear. But no, not only thousands of people wrote to the appeal, it's fair to say that millions did. Millions of letters came in, many of them reporting on conditions, whether in Texas, Florida, Illinois, Kansas, New York. The appeal was centered in southeast Kansas, in Girard. They had correspondents in various places, but it was the people writing to the appeal who made possible the kind of national news that the appeal provided for people. And it should not ever be underestimated how powerful, how influential the press was at this point. Which is to say, there was no TV, there was no radio. So this was absolutely the dominant force for interpreting current, then current, then present American history and culture.
Well, you know, the today's debates are raging now on the internet about the new media, and I can't help but people think back to that time when the newspaper meant something, and you had to literacy was a big part of that. And you know, I want to commend you and thank you for having so many of these photographs, listeners, in Yours for the Revolution. There are these great photographs, very crystal clear, of the appeal and boxcars of the I guess copies going out from the Girard train station. It's an incredible, and then the cartoons. There's these amazing cartoons that appealed into it. There's a picture of Theodore Roosevelt, a rather muscular character, carrying a club behind him, with
big stick,
right, and walking up on this small worker, getting ready to bop him on the head, and to use, I guess, walk softly and carry a big stick. It, you know, the appeal had its moments where it was really smacking down. I mean, sending out major send-ups to the robber barons of its time. Weren't they?
Well, it could, because it had the power of national distribution. And you asked earlier with respect to the post office is there.
Yeah.
One of the ways that the federal government sought to halt, which would be a nice word, destroy might be more accurate, the appeal, is to take from them their second-class mailing privilege, which was the normal second-class mailing privilege that every weekly newspaper, for example, in America had.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal government could find ways to do that. But what the appeal did was send out to its readers and subscribers news of this coming censorship. And its readership and subscribers responded strongly enough, contacting congresspeople, et cetera, that until World War I, the appeal was permitted to publish.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't realize it was until after the outbreak of World War I that it actually became, I guess, more in the target hairs of the federal government. At this time, I think the notorious industrial workers of the world were out there and throughout this period at the same time. So there was a ferment going on in the country that you can read about quite broadly in historical literature today about America. But I think to be actually some of these passages you reprinted in the book are of reports from the work in Butte, Montana. Work in Labette County, all kinds of interesting reports coming in, poetry, fiction, investigative journalism. It's all the hallmarks of what, you know, I mean, it's like we're sort of missing a lot of that today with any kind of single narrative. I'm amazed at the selections. When did you go down? I understand you went. You traveled to Pittsburgh, Kansas, to compile these.
There's a good deal of appeal to reason materials in the Library of Pittsburgh State. I actually had to read the appeal on microfiche, and came out of that after a year or so wearing glasses, because I would have to print off the microfiche, and since I was obviously paying the printing costs,
mm-hmm.
I tried to squeeze as much into duplicate, more or less like a Xerox, But in addition to getting the appeal in microfiche, there's a lot of historical photographs that are available at Pittsburgh State, a number of other materials are available at other libraries. I used, for example, the University of Colorado Western History Library for a good deal. And to put that visual material in, the political illustrations, sought as a way to duplicate the impact and nature of the appeal itself. It wasn't only newsprint, and photography was out, but so were illustrations, the sort of thing that appeared more commonly in late and middle 19th century newspapers and magazines.
Well, it
does have a pretty good flavor of what the Yours for the Revolution has a pretty good flavor of what the appeal actually felt like and looked like.
Well, it's an excellent book, and I really cherish it. And now, you said that earlier, we may have to take a break here in a little bit, but you said earlier the book's still available, or we were talking about that, getting copies of it, still on Amazon.
Yeah, I wasn't aware, because I haven't looked it up lately, that it was available on Amazon, but to my knowledge, because I keep trying to obtain copies and give them away, I came to the end of what I had, and using the internet, found them at a used bookstore in San Francisco, which has about, I think I was told, about 100 copies.
Uh-huh.
And that bookstore is Bolarium, B-O-L-E-R-I-U-M Books. And from its first publication price at $40 a book back in 1990, the book was remaindered by University of Nebraska Press, and now they're available at Bolarium. And I think I paid $10 or $12 a copy.
Yeah.
So anybody who wants to find out about the appeal, its history, and the history that it reflects, would be well advised to go to Bolarium Books.
Yeah, they ought to put it on Kindle. this has been a great opportunity to visit with you, Professor Graham. I was wondering if we could continue our conversation and we talk a little bit more about it.
Sure.
Break. All right, hold on.
Well, so they decided to organize. I mean, it wasn't really a decision to get rammed down your throat. You can only take so much. Then I suppose it was a little easier to identify who the enemy was. The process a bit more subtle than these the waning days of Babylon. Well, of course, then you didn't have free public education, at least not for our booming people. You didn't have mass media. Oh, you had songs, you had stories, and you had conversation. See, today, well, let me put it this way. All of us assign blame in our own best interest, right? Well, if we assign blame in our own best interest, that means blame is relative. And if blame is relative, then one of the important functions in society becomes who controls the blame pattern. Why is it that large bodies of workers, like in my country, assign blame downward to some welfare chiselers down at the bottom? You know, they say trying to get a little bit of something for nothing, and they never assign blame upward to the handful of big-time chiselers at the top that get a whole lot of something for doing nothing at all. Well, that's because the blame pattern is manipulated. Sure, through the public schools. You know, we give our kids over to that when we put them in public school. And then the public schools build in little automatic responses, levers and buttons. When they go into the labor force, you see, then the government reaches out through its media in every home and pushes those buttons and pulls those levers and elicits massive response for or against anything it chooses. Like I say, it was easier to identify who the enemy was. You're booming into the freight yards. You could see the private cars rolled off on the siding. You can see, as you were sweating underground, like in Butte, the mansions being built in a ring on the hills around. See, and the mansions working their way higher up the hill, the deeper you dug yourself into the ground. Okay, easy to see. And the solution was a little easier to see, too. You know, dump the bosses off your back. One thing I should mention is this music is not great poetry. You probably figured that out right away, didn't you? Well, that's because it was real sin had to be simple because people didn't speak a lot of English or had never been to school. But it's not like your modern protest music, which tends to be introverted. A lot of it very poetic. Hard to understand, though. Middle-class music written for middle-class consumption because they got the bread to buy it, okay? What I'm saying, there's a lot of difference between how many miles must a white dove sail before it can rest in the sand and dump the bosses off your back. Now, that's your line in that song, by the way, an old hymn tune, What a Friend We Have in Jesus. The Wobblies like to steal the hymn tunes because they were pretty and changed the words so they made more sense. Are you cold, forlorn, and hungry? Are there lots of things you lack? Is your life made up of misery? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are your clothes all torn and tattered? Are you living in a shack? Would you have your troubles scattered? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are you almost split asunder? Loaded like a long-eared jack? Boob, why don't you buck like thunder and dump the bosses off your back? All the agonies you suffer, you could end with one good whack. Stiffen up, you ornery duffer, and dump the bosses off your back. Ba-ba-ba.
The incredible Utah Phillips. Yes, that's Utah Phillips, also known as Bruce Phillips, I'm informed by Professor Graham. John sent me a nice letter, a really nice letter. I need to write him back. Folks, you want to listen to part two of this, you'll have to wait till tomorrow because now we're going to move on to a little bit more music and Fred Whitehead, who's got some things to say about the hidden heritage of Kansas, as well as some pretty great thoughts from some great thinkers, all from the same period of time, roughly, in our American history. History that's hidden, our hidden heritage, our revolutionary heritage. So many of our fellow Kansans and people out here in America have forgotten about. Here's a little section I wanted to give you, read to you. We'll get back to Utah. The consequences of capitalism's class divisions. This is coming from the book that we've been talking about called The Class Struggle. The consequences of capitalism's class divisions sometimes compelled the appeal to reason to respond with sardonic humor. All you regular listeners know I like humor. A man was arrested and fined in Chicago because he wore women's clothes to get jobs as a washerwoman. John Redpath, a Civil War veteran, with his wife, was found starving in East Brooklyn in spite of a small pension he was drawing. Exploited women workers in a macaroni factory in Fort Worth, Texas, get $4 a week, enough for them to buy the holes in the macaroni they make. A concrete building rising in Indianapolis fell during the noon hour and killed four workmen eating their lunch. Fortunate is the laboring man who can hope to die on a full stomach. An Akron, Ohio man, 35 years old, has just been sent to the penitentiary for 15 years because he stole $10 from a candy store. The way society stole the rest of his lifespan was like taking candy from a baby. You know, folks, you think about these oil rig workers. Well, I guess they just were incinerated, the 11 workers out there on that oil rig out in the Gulf of Mexico here last week. And before that, the 29, that news media, 25, first it was 24, then 25, then 29, coal miners, Virginia. Oh, folks, the class struggle still goes on, and we've got to keep our sense of humor, and it must be sardonic, that's for sure. I hope you enjoy this. I hope you keep it. You can download this at the Blog Talk Radio. Matter of fact, if you go to Blog Talk Radio's website, the book, just scroll down, you'll see the book. You can actually click Yours for the Revolution and get you a copy. There's not a lot of them left out there. Professor Graham was talking about that. Two hardback books, $40. Now you get them for $10, $15. Buy them up. I've had my copy of Yours for the Revolution for over 17 years. When I got that book, I fell out of my chair. I continually pour. I still, to this day, pour over it. There are incredible segments in it. Many reprints and stuff. Professor Graham did a masterful job in reproducing the articles, the cartoons, the photographs, to capture that moment, that rare moment in history out of Kansas. It's a great thing. Really great thing.
Well, now I want to sing about Joe Hill. Joe Hill was in prison in Utah. Well, let me tell you how. Let me tell you about that. My memory has been jogged about that. I've worked at every kind of dumb job you can imagine. Every kind of scumbag boss believable. Viners for Del Monte, all the way to working in state service down as a rat in the basement. I used to come to work 8 o'clock every morning and take the basement stairs down, and the governor would take the stairs up, and we'd shake hands as we passed each other in the hall. My. Kind of thing that would drive you crazy. I mean, not mad. I'm already mad. I don't mind that. That's what the situation requires. But I mean crazy, which is mildly uncontrollable. Was married at the time, living on $512 a month with five of us in the family, trying to buy a house, debt consolidation loans to consolidate my debt consolidation loans. Before Ammon Hennessy taught me that credit was evil, I gave it up. I'd take long walks at night to try to sort my thoughts out, try to put together what my mother had said. She was a CIA organizer, with what thoughts I was feeling. I'd walk to Sugar House, out 21st South and 13th East. When we moved to Salt Lake in 47, that was a big red sandstone prison, Sugar House Prison. Well, about 52, 53, it was torn down for a city park, Sugar House Park. Well, I'd gotten the plat since I worked at the Capitol, a surveyor's plat. And I could walk midnight through that park, and I could stand right on the spot where that white kitchen chair was that Joe Hill was tied to when he was shot. And I would stand and look at the stars and look at the moon and think about what the hell it was I was doing with my life. And before Joe died, before the sun came up, passed a little piece of paper out through the bars to a guard who gave it to a reporter. On that paper was written the words, "My will is easy to decide, for there is nothing to divide. My kin don't need to fuss or moan. Moss does not cling to a rolling stone. My body, if I could choose, I would to ashes it reduce, and let some merry breezes blow them to where some flowers grow. Perhaps some fading flower then might take bloom and live again. This is my last and final will. Good luck to all of you. Joe Hill." I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, live as you and me. Says I was Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake, Joe, great God, says I, am standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead. Says Joe, but I ain't dead. For the copper bosses, they framed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man. Says Joe, I did not die. Says Joe, I did not die. And he's standing there just as big as life, a smiling with his eyes. Says he what they forgot to kill, went on to organize. Went on to organize. From San Diego on up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, says he, you'll find Joe Hill.
says he, you'll find Joe Hill. Yeah, I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, live as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. It never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Fred Whitehead beginning a series of talks for Radio Free Kansas on the subject of Kansas history under the general heading, Our Hidden Heritage. One of the important books of 20th century American history was written by William Appleman Williams, who was a professor of history for many years at the University of Wisconsin and later in Oregon. One of his influential books is called The Contours of American History. In this series, which will follow no particular chronological order, though in the course of the series we hope to cover many significant topics in our history, we'd like to look at what shaped Kansas and shaped Kansas history in terms of the thought patterns, patterns of social organization, ideology, and culture that prevailed here. In his book, Williams talks about his point of departure being Weltanschauung, or worldview. Weltanschauung being, of course, a German term. More usable English term is simply worldview. In his book, Williams is concerned to trace the deep patterns of American history going back to the 18th century and talks about things like mercantilism, even uses the word capitalism, and in some of his other books, Williams was much concerned to explore the idea that empire of some form had been extremely significant in American history. Similarly, this series will look at property rights. For example, the critical feature of 19th century Kansas history, or one of the critical features, was the dispossession of the Native Americans in Kansas Territory, then in the state of Kansas. Many of these tribes, some tribes like the Kansa, for whom the state is named, were native to this area, while others, such as the Delawares and the Wyandots and the Shawnees, were the so-called immigrant tribes who had been forced to come out here from places like Ohio for what they thought and were guaranteed by the United States government to be their permanent home. Another thing we'll be looking at is the formative free state period of the 1850s, where the Kansas-Nebraska Act provided that the question of slavery, and in fact the definition of territorial and pending state government, would be shaped by those who lived in the territory. And of course, slavery being a critical issue, the extension of slavery was favored by people from Missouri, which was a slave state. And this prompted a ferocious armed combat that began in 1855-1856 with fighting, with armed struggle and conflict. the late novelist Truman Nelson came to Kansas, returned to Kansas in 1979, where I interviewed him for a film we subsequently made called John Brown in Kansas. And I remember Truman saying, Kansas was big. It was bigger than Watergate. The momentum of the Free State Movement, which attracted some of the most brilliant and dedicated abolitionists and other free spirits, produced a momentum which extended for several decades after the admission of Kansas as a state on January 29, 1861. This momentum produced what has been called the laboratory of social experimentation, which we will explore in subsequent talks. One of the movements that was highly dramatic was the populist movement of the 1890s, and it is indicative of our present condition that I would wager to say most students, and indeed most people in the state of Kansas, have no idea what populism was and could not define the term. So one of the things we'll be dealing with is the issue of amnesia. And this is not a sort of passive process. I could almost coin a new phrase or a new word. Amnesification. How is it that people could forget? The historian Lawrence Goodwin, in his book Democratic Promise, later abridged as the Populist Moment, states that the populist movement was the largest democratic mass movement in American history. So how is it that this could go into oblivion in public consciousness among our people? To put it more positively, as the novelist William Faulkner said, the past is not dead, it is not even the past. So recovering what happened in Kansas history is, as Meridelle LeSueur, another novelist and writer who grew up in Kansas, said, memory is a revolutionary act. So in this series, we will be endeavoring to take up a good many topics, many of which will probably be surprising to our listeners. What we intend is the restoration of what social scientists call agency. That is to say, how is it that we can develop a toolbox that will lead to definitive alteration in our circumstances and produce the means of transformational change? One of the influential historians of America was Carl Becker, native of Iowa, who earned his doctorate degree at Cornell University in New York. He taught history at the University of Kansas from 1908 to 1916. From Kansas, he went back to Cornell, where he is a member of the faculty until his death. I want to read a passage from Becker's essay entitled Kansas, Just the Beginning. Some years ago, in a New England college town, when I informed one of my New England friends that I was preparing to go to Kansas, he replied rather blankly, Kansas? Oh. The amenities of casual intercourse demanded a reply, certainly, but from the point of view of my New England friend, I suppose there was really nothing more to say. And in fact, standing there under the peaceful New England elms, Kansas did seem tolerably remote. Some months later, I rode out of Kansas City and entered for the first time what I had always pictured as the land of grasshoppers, of arid drought, and barren social experimentation. In the seat just ahead were two young women, girls rather, whom I afterwards saw at the university. As we left the dreary railroad yards behind and entered the half-open country along the Kansas River, one of the pair, breaking abruptly from the ceaseless chatter that had hitherto engrossed them both, began looking out of the car window. Her attention seemed fixed for perhaps a quarter of an hour upon something in the scenic outside, the fields of corn, or it may have been the sunflowers that lined the track. But at last, turning to her companion with the contented sigh of a returning exile, she said, "Dear old Kansas." The expression somehow recalled my New England friend. I wondered vaguely, as I was sure he would have done, why anyone should feel moved to say, "Dear old Kansas." I had supposed that Kansas, even more than Italy, was only a geographical expression, but not so. Not infrequently since then, I have heard the same expression, not always from emotional young girls. To understand why people say, "Dear old Kansas," is to understand that Kansas is no mere geographical expression, but a state of mind, a religion, and a philosophy in one. In the rest of the essay, Becker proceeds to consider sort of Kansas psychology, what it is that makes up the Kansas personality, if you like, or the Kansas mentality. To loosely paraphrase what he says, Kansas is filled with people of rather remarkable types. Carrie Nation, of course, famous for her violent attack on saloons, the great abolitionist John Brown, and so forth. What happened? Why are they here? Well, again, I paraphrase Becker very broadly, very loosely, but the suggestion is that they were all trying to go someplace else, but fell off the wagon and hit their heads, only they didn't die. They crawled to a water hole or were found by other travelers, but they were never the same. And after a while, they became as crazy as everybody else. So in this series, we will be engaged with these vagabonds, some from Kansas, some passing through, some who left never to return, but always shaped in some fashion by their dramatic experiences here.
Everybody else in the neighborhood has packed up their lunchbox and gone off down to Kaiser Aluminum to put in their shift. This enrages my neighbors. One in particular across the road, little retired banker fella, been known to cannonball his rotundity across the road and stand there and publicly berate me for my sloth and indolence. Why don't you get a job, he says. Some of you heard that, I'll bet. Now me being hip to the Socratic method fires back a question. Why? Why, he says, taken aback. If you had a job, you could make $3, $4, $5 an hour. I said, why, pursuing the same tack. Said, hell, you make $3, $4, $5 an hour, you could have a savings account. Save up some of that money. I said, why? He said, well, you save up enough of that money, young fella. Pretty soon you never have to work another day in your life. Said, hell, that's what I'm doing right now. Oh, I like my boss. He's a good friend of mine. That's why I'm starving out on the bread line. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Yeah, and I like Jim Hill. He's a good friend of mine. Say, that's why I'm booming down Jim Hill's main line. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. I guess pretty soon I'll be headed back to Spokane, take up my task of wintering in, and I do a little light farming or heavy gardening, whichever. You know, that kind of farming is hard if you're in this traveling profession. And of course, when you sing like I do, you got to be ready to travel with considerable alacrity. I got a Greyhound bus ticket in my back pocket all the time. But you see, quite often I'm not back in town in time for my plowing or my planting. That's awful. Now, one time I was sharing a platform in New York City, it was, with a bunch of high-powered labor politicos. It was a benefit for the farm workers, that's what it was. I remember Richard Chavez, Cesar's brother, was there. And so was Bella Abzug, former congresswoman from the state of New York. Remember her? Wonderful woman. I mean, she was loud, vociferous, big hat. She was yelling at that audience, righteous beef it was, about how the feds, the FBI, had been opening her mail for ever so long. Well, I knew the feds had been opening my mail for at least 20 years, reading all my personal radical mail, and it never bothered me because I figured them birds had to learn that stuff somewhere, and it might as well be from my mail. But then it occurred to me in my predicament, having the FBI open your mail might come in handy. I sent Sheila, my partner, a letter through the United States Mail, and I said in it, for God's sake, don't plow up the backyard. That's where the guns are buried. National Guard rolled up, dug up the whole backyard in time for me to come back and plant the damn thing. Oh, I went to a bar and I asked for a drink. He gave me a glass and he showed me the thing. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Whenever I get all the money I earn, the boss will be broke and to work he must turn. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. And why don't you save all the money you earn? If I didn't eat, I'd have money to burn. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
This is Fred Whitehead signing on again for Radio Free Kansas. I'm speaking in February of 2010 during a time of a serious economic crisis in the United States. And I've been thinking about an essay that I wrote back in 1982 entitled For a Real Right to Work. In Kansas, we have the Right to Work Amendment to the state constitution, which is so often the case in America,
is the reverse of what it claims to be. Instead of guaranteeing a right to work, it prohibits any requirement that workers join a union in their place of employment. And naturally, this meant that the labor union movement in Kansas in the mid-1950s was stopped dead. In any case, I thought I would revisit this essay and read it for the benefit of listeners of Kansas Public Radio. It refers to conditions in 1982, but the issues that it discusses are, I believe, quite relevant to our present circumstances. Unemployment is a sword continually held over the heads of American workers. At the present moment, as in other depressions in our history, the sword is dropped on more and more people. Even in, quote, good times, unquote, we have a part of our population relegated to permanent misery through the welfare system. In, quote, bad times, unquote, government programs are occasionally developed to address part of this problem. Obvious examples are the WPA programs of the 1930s and the CETA programs of more recent date. Now, CETA, daycare, and other such programs are being eliminated. This, of course, was in the early days of the Reagan administration. This historic tendency reflects a weakness in working class consciousness, which, of course, is understandable given the pervasiveness of capitalist control of all media, schools, and so on. The problem is that work programs are viewed as temporary expedients, as expressions of policy decisions that can and indeed have changed drastically from time to time. Yet just as obviously, unemployment and the threat of it continues to be a major problem of our society. I would like to propose a campaign for an amendment to the United States Constitution reading something like this. Quote, every able-bodied citizen shall have the right to gainful employment. Unquote. Of course, this would have to be a strategic goal, but mounting such a campaign would accomplish several very important things in its course. First, it would make full employment a principle of our entire constitutional system, rather than merely at the mercy of whoever is in power. Secondly, it would provide a means of uniting the working class and ending the often antagonistic competition for what jobs there are. Thirdly, it would take advantage of one of the major slogans of the capitalists, the right to work, and use it against them. And fourthly, it would remove a major weapon from the arsenal of the rulers. They are very aware of their power in this regard, and since almost all contracts have left layoffs to the discretion of the employer, this point of weakness is exactly where they are striking now. Revolutions, said Marx, are based on changes in structure, not changes in style. Such a constitutional amendment might not be enacted without a truly fundamental change, but it would make a great deal of sense to fight for it as a reform measure. There would necessarily be much examination of how socialist countries tried to solve this problem. In fact, except for tribal societies, they're the only ones on earth to have done so. It would propose a most positive change in our society and in our ways of thinking about our own power, our own rights. It would take away the initiative of the right wing, which has mostly monopolized the discussion of constitutional questions, such as with the proposed amendments on school busing, abortion rights, prayer in the schools, and the balanced budget. Of course, there are many questions which immediately arise. How can this be actually implemented? An example here would be the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the current fight for its extension. This act enforces constitutional amendments enacted well over a century ago. There would have to be a substantial amount of implementing legislation, probably similar to the Humphrey-Hawkins bill in its first stages, which provided for large-scale public-private employment programs. Indeed, the fate of Humphrey-Hawkins, watered down in committees and then finally discarded entirely, is a demonstration of the importance of thinking about our basic social structure. Other questions, such as the kinds and qualities of jobs, wages and conditions that would have to be addressed, as well as the right to unionize. There are probably several other amendments which might also be developed, perhaps in the form of a new economic bill of rights. But the right to a job is surely high on the list, not only when many workers are being laid off, but any time whatsoever. At a recent public meeting, I asked a prominent labor leader what his response might be to such a proposal. He had just delivered a powerful 45-minute attack on multinational corporations and how they are sending factories overseas. But to the idea of a constitutional amendment, he replied, "Well, free enterprise is one of the things which has made this country great." He did not seem to be aware of the contradiction in what he was saying. In any case, a campaign for the actual right to work instead of the bogus union-busting laws we have now under that name would ensure the morale of our people and sharply raise our quality of life as we rebuild America. As the great leader of the French Revolution, Danton, said, "Audacity, audacity, and always audacity."
This is Fred Whitehead for Radio Free Kansas. Today's talk has to do with a man named Fred Warren, who was for several years editor of the great Appeal to Reason newspaper published in Girard, Kansas. We'll just remark for the moment that the Appeal to Reason, published by J.A. Wayland in Girard, starting in 1895, was the largest circulation socialist newspaper in the world, 1912, 1915, with 750,000 subscribers to a weekly newspaper. That will be... We'll talk more about the appeal on another occasion. But today I want to talk about an event that occurred May the 4th and 5th, 1909, exactly 100 years ago. Fred Warren was born in Illinois, the son of an unsuccessful businessman, according to the Spartacus website. Warren moved to Rich Hill, a small coal mining town in Missouri, and when he was 18, started a newspaper with his younger brother, Ben Warren. Now, there's a book which I have called The Fighting Editor, or Warren and the Appeal, by George Brewer. I have the second edition published in 1910. This includes some biographical information about Fred Warren, which is quite interesting. He was a firm member at a young age with his newspaper in Rich Hill, firmly committed to the Republican Party. Furthermore, his parents and he were Methodists, and according to Brewer, they had lived their lives as nearly in conformity with the teachings of the lowly Nazarene as was possible. And the struggling young editor was as compromising in his religion as he was and ever had been with all things he conceived to be right. So it proceeds with the description of how Warren had been a Sunday school superintendent and was opposed to the liquor traffic. The Republican Party, says Brewer, in his mind was the personification of all that was pure and undefiled. And because of this honest belief on his part, he ardently threw his life and energy into its support. During the campaign of 1892, he was invited to meet with the principal Republican politicians of Rich Hill to map out a plan of campaign for the ensuing election. Among the principal Republican leaders who gathered in this caucus were two saloon keepers, another prominent Sunday school superintendent of the Presbyterian faith, and several other respected church members of Rich Hill. The most important question discussed in this meeting, and the one that took up the greater part of the time, was how to raise funds with which to buy whiskey and beer for the miners in the adjacent mining camps. Well, this gambit of the Republican leadership, or Republican Party leadership, to essentially buy votes among the miners in exchange for alcohol was, as Brewer says, indeed an eye-opener to the honest young partisan. And as he proceeded, he became more convinced that the Republican Party was deeply flawed and corrupt. Now, the curious story, as Brewer relates it, is thus. It was about this time that it came into his life an individual whom he will never forget. Pat O'Neill, a rough and uncouth miner who lived near Rich Hill, came into his office one day to have a little job of work done. They struck up a conversation, and to the horror of Warren, he found that his visitor was a socialist, the first live one he had ever known. Their conversation became lively, Warren vigorously assailing, as was his custom when forced into verbal combat, as he was in this case. Pat quietly edged in a word now and then with stinging effect until Warren became highly incensed, and had it not been for the size of Pat, he probably would have kicked him out of the office. As it was, however, he soon took his departure, returning in a few days for the job, which was handed to him with a smile, as Warren felt just a bit ashamed that he had permitted his anger to get the better of him on the preceding occasion. Pat good-naturedly smiled in return, and again they proceeded to get into a heated argument. But this time Pat took the initiative and proceeded to explain to his auditor some of the fundamental truths concerning socialism. Upon his departure, Warren asked him to come again, and they would go still further into the subject. It is needless to state that Pat, being an ardent socialist, availed himself of the invitation. From this, the acquaintance ripened into a warm friendship, for Warren found in his Irish friend a kind heart, a clear mind, and an interesting conversationalist. This rugged miner with hands calloused from years of toil and visage hardened by exposure was found to be a man who, rather than be hanged or deported, should be honored and respected for his sturdy manhood and unfaltering fidelity to principle. Warren could see beneath this rugged exterior a heart as tender as a woman's and a strength of character that compelled his admiration. To say the least, Pat O'Neill was honest in his convictions. He believed that socialism was right and zealously advocated its principles. He was certainly entitled to a respectful hearing, and this was given him. For weeks and months he labored patiently with his new pupil, for such it seemed that Warren had become in spite of himself. He had felt the sand slipping from beneath his feet ever since the day of the Republican caucus, when his eyes had been opened to the inside working of the political game, and thus his mind was in a more receptive condition than it would otherwise have been for Pat to work on. It was one day, almost a year after Pat O'Neill had entered his job office, that a stranger handed Warren a little booklet entitled Merry England and asked him to read it and pass it on to someone else. It was the famous socialist pamphlet written by Robert Blatchford, the careful reading of which ruthlessly tore the veil from the eye of the reader, and it suddenly dawned upon him that the author of this pamphlet, Pat O'Neill, and the other socialists whom he had so ignorantly and violently hated were right. No doubt about it, he now knew what was wrong and plunged eagerly into the study of this new and wonderful philosophy. Subsequently, Fred Warren started a paper in Rich Hill called the Bates County Critic. Soon he was made contact with Julius Wayland, publisher of The Appeal to Reason, and then Warren became managing editor of The Appeal. Warren was a well-known figure on the left and managed to persuade some of America's leading progressives to contribute to The Appeal to Reason. This included Jack London, Mother Jones, Upton Sinclair, Scott Nearing, Joe Haglund Hill, Ralph Chaplin, Stephen Crane, Helen Keller, and Eugene Debs. By 1902, its circulation had reached 150,000, making it the fourth largest of any weekly in the United States. In 1904, Warren commissioned Upton Sinclair to write a novel about immigrant workers in the Chicago meatpacking houses. J.A. Whalen provided Sinclair with a $500 advance, and after 7 weeks' research, he wrote the novel The Jungle, first published in The Appeal to Reason in 1905. When published by Doubleday in 1906 in book form, The Jungle became an immediate success. Within the next few years, it was published in 17 languages and remains a classic bestseller to this day. In 1905, William Hayward, General Secretary of the Western Federation of Miners, and Charles Moyer, President of the WFM, were both kidnapped in Colorado and taken to Idaho to stand trial for the murder of Frank Steunenberg, the former governor of Idaho. It became a famous case in American labor history. This upset Warren, as a few years later, the authorities refused to arrest and charge William S. Taylor, the former governor of Kentucky, with the murder of a progressive politician, William Goebel. Taylor fled to Indiana, where he became a wealthy insurance executive. Warren wrote an article about the case and advertised a reward of $1,000 for anyone willing to capture William S. Taylor and take him back to Kentucky. As a result of this article, Warren was himself arrested and charged with encouraging others to commit the crime of kidnap. After a two-year delay, May the 5th, 1909, he was found guilty in Fort Scott, Kansas federal court and sentenced to 6 months hard labor and a $1,500 fine. So today we will remember the conviction of Fred Warren in Fort Scott 100 years ago. This is Fred Whitehead for Kansas Public Radio.
Another one of T-Bone Slim's songs.
Play go wild, simply wild over me, although I've never done them harm that I can see. I'm as gentle as a lamb, but they take me for a ram. They go wild, simply wild over me. Oh, the cop, he went wild over me, and he held his gun where everyone could see. He was breathing rather hard when he saw my union card. He went wild, simply wild over me. Then the judge, he went wild over me, and I plainly saw we never could agree. So I let the man obey what his conscience had to say. He went wild, simply wild over me. Then the jailer, he went wild over me. When he locked me up and threw away the key. Oh, it seemed to be the rage to keep me in a cage. He went wild, simply wild over me. Now they go wild, simply wild over me. I'm referring to the bed bug and the flea. Oh, they murmur in my sleep. They disturb my slumber deep. They go wild, simply wild over me. Will the roses grow wild over me when I've gone into the land that is to be? When my soul and body part in the stillness of my heart, will the roses grow wild over me? Well, and God, he went wild over me. Oh, when I knelt beside the throne on bended knee. Oh, when the angels heard me yell, they shot me down to hell. But they went wild, simply wild over me.
See, now here's a song that you ought to learn. This is not a wobbly song. Well, now wait a minute. Any song a wobbly sings is a wobbly song. Hell, that could be Jingle Bells. Well, okay, we'll accept it. I think this is a particularly important song. Simple as it is, it's just almost like a jingle. Because we know who Joe Hill was. We remember the name Frank Little. We remember the name Wesley Everest, killed by the lumber barons down there in Chehalis, just the Centralia Massacre. We know the names of our martyrs, our Tom Moonies, Sacco and Vanzettis. But the real heroes of the labor movement are all the ones that are buried in those unmarked graves scattered all throughout the West, all throughout the world, who just came to town or into the camp or into the mine to do a job. That's all. Until the door flew open at midnight and those hooded figures grabbed you and dragged you out and hung you under a railroad bridge like they did to Frank Little in Butte, Montana, for resisting a boss's war, a First World War. So many of them, though, thousands of them, just dragged out and killed and left like garbage on the edge of town. They're the ones that we owe, the ones that didn't get into the history books, see? And we've got to remember that. They were just there to do a job. Woody wrote a song about that, Woody Guthrie. Easy as pie. Every verse is pretty much like the one before, so you'll catch on to it. The new dirt's falling on a new-made coffin. The new dirt's falling on a new-made coffin. Way over in that Union burying ground. Oh, tell me who's that they're letting down, down. Oh, tell me who's that they're letting down, down. Oh, tell me who's that they're letting down, down. Way over in that Union burying ground. Another Union organizer. Another Union organizer. Another Union organizer. Way over that Union burying ground. A Union mother, a Union father. A Union mother, a Union father. A Union mother, a Union father. Way over that Union burying ground. A Union brother, a Union sister. A Union brother, a Union sister. A Union brother, a Union sister. Way over that Union burying ground. Every new grave brings 1,000 members. Every new grave brings 1,000 members. Every new grave brings 1,000 members. Way over that Union burying ground.
I'm a red cat till I die, I'm telling you. best excuse. Now I might not have been the president I did, but tell me what's the use? Might have been an FBI man, but I ain't no peace in town. Then I might have been the deputy, and I put my white sheet on. But I'm a red cat till I die. I'm a red cat through and through. I won't fight your rich man war and kill poor folks for you. Now you can make me do things I know it's wrong to do. I'm a red cat till I die. I'm killing you.
Here's this is Mike Cadell, your host. Play a little bit of new music after this. We're in our closing moments. To remind you that tomorrow will be part two with over 1 hour with Professor John Graham and more selections from Fred Whitehead commemorating May 1st and more with Graham discussing the appeal to reason. Here is the text of a December 4th, 1915, the appeal to reason was under increasing attack. And here was a famous postcard sent out by Jack London, censored by the Postmaster General. "Here is a good soldier," by Jack London, which has aroused the militarists of this nation to the extent that Postmaster General Burleson has barred from the mails envelopes containing this article. The appeal to reason was threatened with a fraud order if it persisted in sending envelopes through the mails containing London's article. The Postmaster General did not even give the appeal a chance in the courts. He said, quote, "Either stop circulating a good soldier on envelopes or we will close up your doors by refusing to deliver a single piece of mail to you," unquote. So in free America, the appeal has been forced by a war censor to take this means to circulate Jack London's criticism of the soldier's profession. A Good Soldier, by Jack London. Young man, the lowest aim in your life is to be a good soldier. The good soldier never tries to distinguish right from wrong. He never thinks, never reasons. He only obeys. If he is ordered to fire on his fellow citizens, on his friends, on his neighbors, on his relatives, he obeys without hesitation. If he is ordered to fire down a crowded street when the poor are clamoring for bread, he obeys and sees the gray hairs of age stained with red and the life tide gushing from the breasts of women, feeling neither remorse nor sympathy. If he is ordered off as one of a firing squad to execute a hero or benefactor, he fires without hesitation, though he knows the bullet will pierce the noblest heart that ever beat in human breast. A good soldier is a blind, heartless, soulless, murderous machine. He is not a man. He is not even a brute, for brutes only kill in self-defense. All that is human in him, all that is divine in him, all that constitutes the man, has been sworn away when he took the enlistment oath. His mind, conscience, his very soul, are in the keeping of his officer. No man can fall lower than a soldier. It is a depth beneath which we cannot go. Once again, mailed from Girard, Kansas, December 4th, 1915. Folks, part two of the appeal to reason will follow high noon tomorrow, Saturday. I hope you listen in. That was Recruiter. Here is Recruiter's Strike. Thank you.
I got off the train one evening in a little mining town. I started walking up the main street when the sun was going down. When I heard some voices singing, so I went to see what for. Might just be a birthday party, and it might be room for just one more. But it was miners and their family. They had left the mine that day, walked out in safe condition, on strike for decent pay. And they sang about their struggles, never afraid. Keep your hand up on the dollar and your eye up on the scale.
Hope you enjoyed tonight, part one of the Appeal to Reason. Part two begins by noon tomorrow, Saturday, at Radio Free Kansas. We'll close with some new music that you'll be hearing tomorrow as well. Here's Dave Rolex. Behind the Barricades played at Manhattan, Kansas, at the Universal Unitarian Fellowship Hall several years ago. Good night. I'm your host, Mike Goodell. I'm very proud to bring this show to you.
When the world has gone crazy, and it's all becoming clear, when they're gunning down our comrades, and it seems the end is near, as they're loading up the launchers for the tear gas grenades, we can take off our bandanas and kiss behind the barricades. When it's madness all around, and you can see this at a glance, we will sing and we will cry, we will laugh and we will dance. As they shout their marching orders beneath the helicopter blades, we shall seize the moment for a kiss behind the barricades. They will try to break our spirit, and at times they may succeed, but our love for the world is stronger than their greed. When the building is surrounded and hope begins to fade, in my final hour, a kiss behind the barricades. As the movement grows, there will be hills and bends, but at the center of the struggle are your lovers and your friends. And the more we hold each other up, the less we can be swayed. Here's to love and solidarity, and a kiss behind the barricades.
Jimmy Maxton, James McDiddle, Bob Bergnelligan and McShane, Agnes Dolan, Helen Crawford, up at the feet, great John McLean. These are some of the red lights I'd have hundreds more and wish to name. A monument that reigns forever, these are the flower of Scotland's fame. McDougall fell hard in prison, came back with a broken shell. He did the same to young John Muir. 8 long months in the jaws of hell, his only crime was saying no to slaughter in the rich man's war. Property is theft, he said, don't die for what you can live for. Tax and tax for common folk, some for money lender. The old church pew, the white and blue, the cult and the young pretender, keep us swear, but what makes them fear? It's what red and the red white ciders. Every Sunday night at Bath Street, John McLean roared to his spiel. Thousands gathered round to hear him. He spoke loud and he spoke well. 15 years I've been a soldier, fighting for the cause, he said. Oh, no, stop now, no, you might jail me. Prison walls at any dread. John was with the first edition, Muir and Gallagher, Maxton too. Ah, the leader so red twice, I trotted out for public view. While others fled and begged for mercy, John threw caution to the wind. You stand accused, he told the judge, with the blood of millions on your hands. Rags and tags for common folk, silver money lender. The old church pew, the white and blue, the kilt and the young pretender, keep us swear. But what makes them fear? It's what red and the red white ciders. Torture by the screws in prison, force-fed with the poison food. Haunted, shattered, still not broken, up on the kirk he proudly stood. That night when John James came to Glasgow, weak of body, white of hair, red light burned as bright as midday. Then the tanks rolled through the square. What
miners' blood splashed over the flagstones. Soldiers came with tanks and guns. Beats were broken, spirits too. The final chapter had begun. That treachery on Bloody Friday sent a stench to Heaven's Gate. John said, we'll build our own republic. The fight for justice can't wait. Rags and tanks were coming home. Some for money lenders. The oaks are skewed, the white and blue. The tilts and the young pretender keep us square. But what makes them fair? It's worth trying the red line side up.